You're listening to the Rock Mop Podcast, featuring in-depth interviews with your favorite signed and unsigned artists on their musical journeys, life sacrifices, tour stories, and more. Get up close and personal with our guests and tune in every week for brand new episodes. Now, here's your host, Ryan Bennett.
Welcome to the Rock Mop Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Bennett. And before I get too far into this next episode, I do want to throw a quick word out for an amazing sponsor. Misunderstood Designs and Primarily Blue Video, your one-stop shop for all things digital creative, logo design, graphic design, web design, branding, video production, editing, animation, camera work, printing, and all kinds of amazing artwork and design work. Design your business at Misunderstood Designs and Primarily Blue Video, and check out their work at primarilyblue.com. Remember, perception is everything. That's my boy, Gogi Randhawa. Check out his website and all his amazing work. So, you were here for the Rock Mob Podcast, Episode 2. We are still a baby, but I have so many cool things to come, including this episode, which I hold very dear to my heart. I got to sit down with a good friend of mine, Mike DeWolf from the band Taproot, guitar player. I grew up in my early 20s just fucking listening to this band all the time, getting into all their early records, Gift, Welcome, and all their stuff. Big influence on me. Went to all their shows. I went on to be able to open up for them at a club in Atlanta called The Loft with my former band called Subject to Change, and met them, and super cool dudes. This is my first time opening for, you know, some fucking idols, some, you know, guys that I really looked up to, and they didn't crush my dreams. They weren't assholes. They were all super fucking cool. And then fast forward years later, I got to do two lengthy tours with them with my last band, Dear Enemy. And I met them again on tour. We went out with Seven Dust and Taproot and did 4 weeks. It was about 30-something shows, East Coast tour, and had such a good time with the Taproot guys that they decided to take us out as direct support on their national tour. You know, took us out west and Midwest, through the South, fucking everywhere. It was amazing experience, and got to really, you know, got to know the guys and just had a fucking blast, and, you know, got to be real good friends with Mike and kept up with Mike over the years, and, you know, we'd shoot each other happy Father's Day texts and all that, and just kind of catch up with each other, see how we're doing. And they came back through Atlanta, which they don't play Atlanta too often, but came back through the Masquerade, and, you know, I took the opportunity to sit down with them and at the Masquerade and, you know, have our little podcast interview and just fun talk. We didn't get to get into a whole lot of what we wanted to talk about because of doors, and there's a show starting, and a matter of fact, there's a band that's sound checking in the background, which you'll hear. I don't know what band it was, unfortunately. I would love to give them credit. They sounded pretty cool. It was a different stage. They were playing in heaven, and Taproot was in hell. Anyway, we're going to get on into this podcast. Thank you for listening. RockMobPodcast.com. Keep coming back. More awesome episodes with members from Dark New Day, Seven Dust, Static X, and Typo Negative. It's just some fucking awesome lineups that we got going on here at the Rock Mob Podcast. So I'm going to end the podcast today with a Taproot song, and we're going to go from here. Fucking rock on. Thanks again for listening. What's up? Welcome to the Rock Mob Podcast. This is your host, Ryan Bennett. Today I have a good friend and longtime awesome musician, Mike DeWolf from the band Taproot. Welcome to Atlanta, man. This is a live interview.
Thanks for having me. It's a wonderful town. Got to eat some really good food, hang out a little bit, and now we're at the beautiful Masquerade.
Yes, I've seen you guys here several times, heaven and hell.
Yes. I don't know, my drummer asked me how many times we played here, and my best guess is like 8, 10, I don't know, right? A lot.
Two numbers, double digits, yeah, it's a beautiful place. Well, I don't know about beautiful, but it's
I like it.
Beautiful,
I think
history.
It's beautiful, yeah.
heaven, hell, and purgatory, and the scary shit we saw up in the background.
Yeah, I'm not cool with that stuff.
Yeah, well, cool. I appreciate you doing this podcast with me, and I'm glad that we talked about doing it over the phone, and it kind of met up for you to, you came to Atlanta, my hometown, and we get to do this. It's cool.
Face to face, not on the phone.
Right. Yes. That noise right there was a handshake. Cool. Well, I want to kind of start. I got a lot of stuff I want to talk about and touch base on. And, first off, I want to know some things I don't know about you. Where you started, like, even before you started playing music, what was the little Mike DeWolf like before music came over and took over your life?
Oh, man. I was... early on, I was like, my older brother got me into music pretty early on, and he introduced me to like the Sex Pistols, The Clash, AC/DC, Led Zeppelin, later on Guns N' Roses, Metallica, that kind of stuff. And so I was exposed to a lot of music from an early age, and I kind of just, that was always there since the beginning. So I always kind of loved music and looked up to, you know, the people that played music or whatever. But I played a ton of sports also, like every sport that you can think of pretty much. For the most part, it was hockey. So I played hockey all the way up to, I think, my second year in high school. And then something happened with one of my coaches. One of my friends was starting to get pretty heavy into drugs. And I went to my teacher at the time, who was also the coach, and I was like, hey, man, you know, this is what's going on. And, you know, can you help us out? And he basically turned his back on us.
No way.
And I said, what the fuck is that, you know? Like, that was just, that changed my whole scope of the world. So I quit hockey, looked around at my bedroom, and I was like, all right, I have posters, and my room is plastered in rock and metal stuff, painted all the walls red with the white stripes like Eddie Van Halen.
Nice.
And I was like, maybe I should get a guitar.
I had my same, all my walls covered too, and I had an entire Metallica wall.
Oh, yeah.
Took black Sharpie and fucking put, Metallica, the logo on there, and wrote the lyrics to Live Is to Die on my closet door, and my dad fucking yelled at me, thought I was going to commit suicide.
Yeah.
So I'm right there with you, man. But cool. So that kind of, I need to be on those posters on some kid's wall one day.
I don't know if I said that at the time, but I definitely wanted to. I knew the music was inspiring to me, and so I kind of was hoping that I could do something similar like that. Like I knew before I even got a guitar that I didn't want to, or nor could I play like Eddie Van Halen, but I wanted to to make something that something in the way that their music inspired me and made me feel, you know, so I wanted to do something like that.
Cool. So how'd you end up getting your first guitar?
I was very lucky and blessed. My mom and dad supported me and took me out, helped me pick out a guitar. And
did you get the Eddie Van Halen?
No. That was like right when his first guitar came out, I think.
Oh yeah,
because I remember that was like one of the pictures on my wall was an ad for his new guitar. I was into Sepultura, and like I said, AC/DC, and I went to the music store, is a local mom and pop shop, and they had a Warlock. And yes. An SG. Those are my two. I had my eye on those two things. And thank God I bought an SG. Because if I didn't, I don't think I would have continued on. But I got a Gibson SG and a little amp. A little later down the road, I was able to get a 5150 half stack.
Nice, so, nice.
So that's kind of where I started with music and.
Your first real true tube amp, you had a half stack, and it's like, yeah. Now it's time to fucking be a rock musician.
For sure, but I know I had that thing for at least a year before I knew what to do with with anything, with myself. So,
right.
But one day, you know, I was playing in my room, and a riff came out, and I was like, okay, I know what to do now. I can write a song. Like, I can do my own stuff. Like, so there was just, like... It didn't come quick, but once it happened, it was like, okay, I can do this.
It started pouring out.
Yeah.
I know a lot when I was young, starting to play, I'd learn other people's music, do tabs, and it'd be too hard, and I'd fuck up sometimes, yeah. And then I'd be like, oh, well, that's my riff now.
Yeah.
And that's how, it's kind of...
Yeah, once you allow yourself the authority to say, this is mine.
Right? Then you can write your own fucking music.
Yeah, you're all good.
So how did all that translate into turning into starting a band? How did you start your first band? And, and what was the band name?
It was pretty early. Oh, God. It was pretty early on. I think in ninth grade, I had a class with this guy from another school. You come together in high school or whatever. I met this guy named Damon Root, and he had a guitar, and I was like, oh, you know. He would wear, like, Sex Pistol shirts and stuff, so, like, I knew, like, I'm like, I'm into that, you know. And he's like, I have this friend that plays the drums. You should get your guitar and come on over and hang out with us. And so I did that. And when I got there, it was Steven Richards, my now singer. And I was like, hey, I know you. And he was like, hey, I know you. We met in the third grade. We were in the same class together.
No way. Third grade.
And we were best friends in third grade.
Oh shit!
I have pictures of us, me at his birthday, at putt-putt golf.
3 years old,
in third grade.
Okay, third grade.
But so
wow,
yeah.
Did not
so
know that.
We came back together. That was in the ninth grade, and we started playing. The original name for those three guys was VOD. Which, you know, you've heard of, but this right. one stood for Volume Overdose.
Volume Overdose.
Because at the time, we had the smallest amps you could ever imagine.
So it was a pun then,
yes,
really.
A play on
words rather than like Michael J. Fox and Back to the Future with the fucking...
Yeah, no.
Not that. Wow, so, okay, I was going to ask you all these questions about how your first band, you know, broke up and everything and all this and other bands you played in, but you basically have had Taproot all your fucking life.
Well,
basically.
I mean...
You and Steven,
Yeah, me and Steven have been together. Damon Root eventually moved away. And then Steve and I kept up and met some other guys, much, much older dudes, you know. And we would literally play in any bar and any place that we could possibly play. Out in fields, in barns, you know. We would play shows as much as we could. Even though, like, at the time, I'm still a really shy dude. But for me, that was one of my biggest obstacles, was getting up on stage. Like,
really?
I did not want to do that.
No?
in school, if I had to do a speech in front of the class, I would not go. I would not
go
that day. So I was terrified, but...
So how did you overcome stage fright then?
I just knew, like, if this is what I was going to do, I was going to have to do it. Like, there's no other way about it, and so I just got up there and did it. But we played in several bands, and all along the way, it was always me and him that were writing all the music and all the lyrics.
And he was the drummer,
yeah,
right?
Originally he was... In all these bands, he was the drummer.
Wow.
But me and him would write all the music and all the lyrics and tell these other guys, you know, do this, do that. And we were in ninth grade, 10th grade, and they're like 30-something.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, but at some point, we played with a band They were called Simonic Drive, and they had two dudes in the band that really stood out, and we were like, hey, you know, we should hook up with them, and they were thinking the same thing, so we all hooked up, and that was the very first, the very beginning of Taproot. We were only really together for a short period of time, and then I was like, hey, Steve, why don't you, you know, you're putting together a lot of the melodies and whatnot, why don't you get out there and sing instead of us trying to get some other dude to do what you're already doing well and this other guy not being able to do it very well. You know, I think it would be better off, you know, doing something like that and finding a drummer that'll do, then it might be a little harder to find a singer. So
was that tough for him to give up his passion for playing drums?
I think so. He makes little comments here and there. So
yeah. So I've heard him play. He's fucking awesome.
Oh yeah, no, he loves. Yeah, he's good as hell. But I do also know that he he's got like carpal tunnel. Really messes up. Like, he'll play for like 15 minutes and be like, all right. That hurts.
It's a blessing in disguise that he moved on.
I think so.
Well, of course, because he's a singer at Taproot. Hey, you guys are Taproot. Yeah. So he went over to play to vocals, and did Phil come in the mix right then, or is that later? How did Phil and Jared, the original lineup of Taproot, actually come together?
Yeah, I mean, once we decided the whole singer thing, then it was like, all right, now we know we need to find a... Oh, well, at the time, we were like, we'll just use a drum machine. Why do we need a drummer? You know? We're determined this is what we're going to do.
So, and drum machines back then are like Boss DR5s or something.
Yeah. So, because we had already written some songs, you know, and it was all with the drum machine, blah, blah, blah. But so we needed a bassist. So Steve's cousin... was going to the University of Michigan and living in a college house with a bunch of other people, and Phil and our future drummer Jared both lived there with him. So we met them that way. First off, we wanted a bassist, so we brought Phil in. We played one show without a drummer.
No, you
with
did.
A drum machine. So at that show, there was probably 15 people there, but Steve somehow managed to unplug the drum machine in mid-song or whatever. So I was like, "All right, this blows. We need something else." So, so we asked Jared to join in, and we just went from there. That was the beginning of Taproot.
Wow, that's something else. So you guys played shows as a local band, I guess, and did you do any touring before you end up signing your first record deal?
We played shows. We made it like a full-time gig, like a full-time job. we played shows at once or twice a week anywhere that we could. We live on the campus of the University of Michigan. 10 minutes down the road is the Eastern Michigan University, and then we have MSU, Michigan State University, about an hour away. So we would just ping pong back and forth, and I mean, we figured out pretty early on, since we've been playing in bars all this time, it was like, they don't care what you sound like, they don't care who you are, what you look like, anything. They want people there drinking. Yep. And so we're like, okay, that college crowd is the ones that are going to be there drinking. So we made friends, and we just worked it like that. But we'd play the shows. We didn't do a lot of touring around, going outside of our state. We did a tiny bit, but basically we're focusing on trying to make some noise in Michigan and, you know, bring some eyes on us. So another way we would do that was on the internet at the time, there were like no rules. You could go on guest books and put whatever you want anywhere and everywhere, and we would do that. 24/7. Like, hey, have you heard this band? This is the coolest fucking band in the world, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And
talking about yourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Plaster that everywhere, and you can be anybody at that time. You could be Joe, Bob, Tina, this, that, and
so
the other.
You created your own little buzz about yes. yourselves.
And we were selling, we sold up to like 10,000 CDs, of which we burnt ourselves, cut out every single insert, folded every single CD insert, put them in.
Yeah,
And at the time, we were burning on like toast.
Yeah,
that's what the program was. And, yep. and you couldn't burn like fast. It took a long time.
So you sit there and you pop each one in, you wait.
Yep.
In. I did all the same shit too.
But like I said, they were students at the University of Michigan. So we used all their resources.
Yep.
So we would wake up and get there at 6 in the morning and be the first ones in the door to get on all the computers before any of the students could come in and take them up.
So that's how you created your buzz. That's yep. genius.
Thanks. We worked hard, man.
So was that all kind of in promotion for your old demo that you had? Or was it called Upon Us? Is that right?
Yeah, we had a couple. We had Something More Than Nothing, Upon Us, and Meant to Be. And some people call it Mentobe.
Mentobe.
But yeah, we'd record a batch of songs, put that out, record another batch of songs, put that with the other batch of songs, put that out, you know.
Yeah.
Just do whatever we could. So
that's great. So how did Atlantic Records find you guys? How did you guys sign that deal?
We were building early on, kind of, or sort of, we made friends with the guys in Limp Bizkit, Fred Durst, and we sent him a demo. He loved what he heard, said he wanted to work with us, and he seemed totally genuine, and we'd hang out every time. They would come through anytime, and but he had so much going on at the time. He was working with other bands. His band was blowing up massively. So we kind of got left on the back burner. Rightfully so, I guess. But for me, I was like, all right, well, we got to go, you know, we got to make this happen for ourselves. And if he's not going to help us.
So did he kind of like get y'all's hopes up real high? And he's like, you know, we're going to do all this.
Yeah.
And just kind of left you guys high and dry.
Right. But I wasn't going to let that, like, knock me down. That served as motivation, you know. Like,
now you know you have something that point
for sure. But at the same time, it was like, well, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
Like, I'm gonna go do this on our own, you know. Like, we can do this. We don't need anybody. So
yeah.
So like I said, we just worked. Like 6 o'clock in the morning till 2 at night, working on the website. All the promotions, burning CDs, cutting out all the stuff, playing shows. But so we created a pretty big buzz on the internet, and our David Benvenisti from, at the time it was Streetwise, which was a big promotions company, and Velvet Hammer Management contacted us. And sent out one of his guys, and he watched it. They actually set us up on a show with System of a Down, which was one of their bands, and they sent out one of their guys, and he watched us play, and they were like, all right, let's see what we can do with this. They brought us out to LA, and we played for Rick Rubin. Some people might know about that guy.
A couple, maybe.
Yeah, so that was pretty crazy. We're just in a big rehearsal room, and he's sitting back, lounging, watching us play. We're sweating bullets.
Are you putting on your a quasi live show, a fake live show
in front of one person? Yep. Yes, one very important person.
That kind of been a bit nerve wracking.
Yeah, it was. But very cool at the same time. But that's when all this stuff went down with Fred, and he heard about us playing for Rick and got upset about it, left a crazy phone message, and he was just not happy about it.
And that message is quite the infamous message. A lot of everyone fucking knows about it. And
you can find it online.
How did that go? Now, that was something to go quote unquote viral back then.
That was viral.
It was like the first of viral. How did something like that get leaked? And was that voicemail recorded by you guys? You're like, listen to this fucking asshole, and then it went out.
It was on Steve's mom's answering machine. They had these things back in the day. They were called answering machines. They had little tapes in them.
You had to rewind it.
Yeah. So somehow, I guess, quote, our manager got a hold of it and leaked it out there. I think that's what happened.
It was wise. I mean, itself blew up so much controversy and stuff. And it kind of almost put you guys on, not that solely, but you guys got put on the map, when you, that went through.
It definitely upped our visibility.
There you go. Yeah. So then you signed the deal, and what did Rick Rubin actually say anything to you that day? Or
We didn't actually sign with Rick. He kind of passed on it. He thought we were a good band, but it wasn't like that spark he was looking for, you know? So we showcased for several other labels. I think we went to New York and did a couple, and then our A&R guy from Atlantic Records, who we eventually signed with, came out to Michigan, watched us play a show, then had us fly out to LA and showcase for him and some of the other guys at Atlantic, and then that's when we signed our first deal.
Awesome. So were you in LA when you actually signed the deal and everything? That's awesome. So how long from the time that you signed to the time that they put you in the studio and you started working on Gift?
I have no idea, but it wasn't very long. We got right to it pretty much. I really can't remember, but it couldn't have been too long. They basically just put us in the studio with Ulrich Wild, our producer. We pretty much had all the songs. I think we wrote a couple, maybe two or three extra for the album, and we just did it.
So had you worked on all your demos and stuff that you had sold tens of thousands of copies to? Did you work with any producers back then, or is this your first time?
Back then it was, we just had this local guy, Tim Pack, that we'd use his studio, and he would help push some buttons around, get us what we wanted. Not
they're more engineer rather than producers.
Yeah.
Right? So,
but I mean, at the same time, Ulrich, I mean,
same thing.
But we put a lot more trust in him. We thought, okay, we're working with a fairly big name producer. He should know what he's doing, you know, for sure. So we kind of step back a little bit. Whereas on our demos, we did everything. We're like, this needs to be like this. This needs to be like that. This is, keep going, But so we stepped back a little bit, and I think Ulrich did a great job. But at the same time, I don't think we were ever really happy with it. I think we all thought that. Wow, we did an amazing job on our demos. It's like we're a little let down, but it's still a great album. So
yeah, I think that's one that defines you guys. Yeah. It's the one that set you guys off. After you recorded your album, you started going on tour, like for real at this point.
Oh yeah.
And what was your first tour that you did as a signed Taproot?
Oh boy,
do you remember?
I think our first tour was with Papa Roach.
Awesome.
Yeah, and at the time, before we got signed, they were doing exactly what we were doing. They were just pounding the internet, creating the exact same buzz that we were doing the exact same thing. So when we went out on tour, like, they could respect us and we could respect them, and So that was really cool. But I think that was just a really short tour, I believe. And then we went out with on Ozfest.
Ozfest. Now, was it true that some kind of correlation or knowing Jack Osborne helped you guys get on that?
For sure. our manager at the time knew Sharon really well and put it in her ear and into Jack's ear to Jack Osborne and had him come over to some of our rehearsals for our first album. He hung out. He loved us. We took him back to our apartment. We're staying. They have like these long-term apartments out there for actors and musicians, whatever, the Oakwoods. And he came over and played video games with us, hung out. So we kind of got in that way.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So Ozfest. How was it being on Ozfest? Tell us a little bit about that.
It's pretty ridiculous. It's just a big, fun summer camp for bands. Be able to play for that many people every day is just a blessing, you know? So we're very lucky and happy to do it.
And you guys said also after Ozfest and then several other tours and whatnot, you came back with Welcome. We went back in the studio. What producer did you work with on that one?
Toby Wright.
Toby Wright.
Yeah. He's amazing.
No doubt, which is an awesome album. And you also did then Blue Sky Research. And after Blue Sky, Jared left. Is that right?
He left after the next album, which was Our Long Road Home.
My bad.
No, that's okay. After Blue Sky Research, which was also with Toby Wright, that was a long process making that album. But after that, everything in the music industry started going to pieces, and a lot of people got laid off at our record company, including our A&R guy. So that left us kind of hanging.
That was with Our Long Road Home. Wasn't that put out by yourselves?
Right? Yep. So after Blue Sky Research, we had some talks and decided we were going to try and release something on our own with our management company. And that was Our Long Road Home. a lot of people didn't or weren't exposed to it just because we didn't have the power of, Atlantic Records behind it. But I feel like that's one of my favorite albums. So.
Yeah, I love it. And that's the album that, because Jared left. I thought it was before that, but that's right.
He did that album with us, but then
he didn't tour.
He didn't tour. Yeah.
And you guys didn't tour for quite some time. And then you came back and toured. You went on tour with Seven Dust. And then at Seven Dust is where we kind of bring in our relationship. Because that's where. Now, before, I'd played a show in one of my previous bands in Atlanta, opened up for you guys. And that was I think that was with Blue Sky. That was on Sky Research tour. And then.
Where do we play?
The Loft at Center Stage Complex.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That place is awesome.
Yeah,
we
really
just talked
cool.
about that last time, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so that was my first time meeting you. And then coming back around, I'm like, oh, shit, that's fucking awesome. I get to go on tour. Your steps put 10 years before, or no way, I mean, other way around. Basically, I'm like a local band, unsigned band. I get to go on tour with my favorite fucking bands, Taproot and Seven Dust, because I've been a Taproot fan myself since 97, since Gift came out and everything. I've seen you at the Cotton Club, the place that is now a pretentious nightclub where Steven fell. For those that don't know about that, that was a pretty big thing. And Steven came because he would always, anytime I'd see you guys back in the day, he would always climb a rafter or climb the balcony and jump into the crowd or something fucking ridiculous. And he climbed up these booths that were about 15 feet high. And he was going to jump off the back, but the back was not like plywood like he had.
Yeah, it was like a faux ceiling.
Yeah.
So he stepped on it thinking he would have some support, and it just dropped, and he fell all the way down into this like trap.
It was totally a trap because it was a booth backed up to a wall, and the back of the booth was 15 fucking whatever feet. Yeah. So it's straight down. And I just remember, I think you guys stopped playing or something. And then he's like, can I get some help back?
I'm stuck. Yeah.
That was fucking awesome. Yes. And Pulse Ultra played that show with you guys.
Oh, yeah. Those guys. They actually, the guitarist, Dominic, we're playing in Montreal, I believe. And opening for, believe it or not, Marilyn Manson. We opened a couple of shows for Marilyn, and Dominic knocked on our bus door. He had a demo in one hand and a six pack of Heineken in the other, and I was like, "Hey, come on up."
Nice.
So we hung out. When he left, I listened to their demo, and I called our A&R guy, and I was like, I found an amazing band. And Atlantic, Tom at Atlantic eventually signed them.
So you were behind that. That's just genius, because that band was, that album, Headspace, was just
so good.
Phenomenal.
Yeah.
And for nothing, you know, to happen after that, which is kind of like, you know, lead singer from, you know, syndrome from what I heard. You know, this and that and that and this. It kind of has a, you know, similar situations to my last interview with City Sleeps, where the singer, you know, ruined everything. I don't know if right. that's really everything that happened with Pulse Ultra.
No, just not everything worked together properly, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Things have to align.
and they did not, and that's very unfortunate. But fast forward back to what we were just talking about, the Seven Dust tour, that kind of that was your first tour without Jared as well.
Yeah.
You had Nick on tour, and amazing guy.
Yeah.
Did not sing backup vocals, though, and backup vocals Jared did, which was a big part of your live show and everything. How did you guys feel on stage? How did you feel on stage and going through all the motions without having Jared there and having a new drummer after all those years?
I guess it was an adjustment, but we were just trucking on, you know, like doing the best we could. I don't think we had a ton of time to get our shit together before we had to head out. So that was kind of like the last thing. You know, first of all, we need to get our band playing together before he starts trying to sing. So we just worked on that, and basically we were thrown out onto the road. So we didn't have enough time to make that work, and we just kind of left it at that. And that's what we were from then on. For us, it was live was always, to some degree, a whole different thing from the album. I think for a long time we never used any of the electronics that were on our first album. We just didn't use that live. So it was just like two completely different things in our eyes. I know, like, a lot of people miss, you know, if we don't do something, you know, like a backup vocal or some of the programming that's on the record, then some people might miss that, but some other people might not care.
It's a fucking rock show.
Yeah, it's like, who cares, just get out there and do whatever you do.
Yeah, absolutely. So then you guys went on and did two more records after that, Plead the Fifth, and who did Nick play drums on that?
Yes, for the most part.
And Nick and Steven.
Yes.
And then the Episodes, the most recent one, which is a concept record.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
That one we actually made years before, when right in the middle of our long road home. We had written a bunch of songs for that, and then we were kind of at a standstill, like, we weren't really getting anywhere. I was sitting at home watching VH1 Classics. What's the show? I was watching documentaries on Pink Floyd and The Who. And I was watching about, you know, how they put together their concept albums or whatever. And I was like, holy crap, man. In theory, Steve and I could bust out an entire album written and demoed in 15 days, you know, or 10 days. If we want to do 10 songs, 10 days we could do that.
Wow.
So, so the idea was like, here, all we do is write a story. Doesn't fucking matter what the story is. Who cares?
Right?
This is an experiment. So, write out the story, break it into 10 chapters or 10 episodes, which what we ended up calling it, and kind of work them into lyrics, and then write all the music to the lyrics.
Which is probably backwards from what you guys...
Absolutely backwards. Yeah. But we literally did that. It may have taken us an extra day to come up with the story and write it out, but once we had that, we literally wrote the lyrics and the song and demoed that song in one day.
Wow.
Then we come back the next day, another song, another song, another song, and it was done. So that was right in the middle of making our Long Road Home. But at the time, and Steve and I were in love with it, like, because I guess of the fact that we had never done anything like that. We're working completely ass backwards. We thought it was one of the best things we had ever done and would ever do. But some of the management and some other people didn't necessarily think like that was the right thing to release at the time. And so we're like, yeah, okay, whatever. So we put it on the back burner. But all those years after, we would still listen to it all the time and enjoy it. So, yeah, when it came time for our 6th album, I guess it was, we were like, all right, let's do this.
Let's put it out. Yeah. It's already done.
Yeah, well, it was done, but we kind of tried to work with our producer, Tim Padlin, who's pretty much back home. He's like 10, 15 minutes away from us. Out on the farm. It's beautiful. We'd work with him and try and update the sounds and iron everything out, try and make it the best it could possibly be. Because, like I said, we only spent a day on each song.
Right.
So all the ideas were there, and we thought it was a great idea. And I think we brought it up to a bigger, better place.
Awesome. So that album's out now, your most recent one. You're touring on that extensively. And what can we expect next out of Taproot?
Oh, at the moment, all we can expect is a nice, much-deserved, much-needed break.
Is that right?
Yeah, we're going home, and we're going to relax for a while.
It's probably well needed, yeah. Well-deserved at that,
We've been touring...
Nonstop.
Forever.
So. Yeah. Okay, well, that's awesome. Now there's a lot more kind of topics I want to talk about. More of kind of personal mic stuff rather than all Taproot and everything. However, we're at the Masquerade and doors are opening at 7.
All right.
It's 7:00.
Hey, we can always do it again.
Yeah, we can, exactly. Which is what I want to say. We'll do a part two of
awesome.
This, and that'll be we'll do that by phone because you'll be in Michigan. I'll be on your break. I'll be fucking doing these podcasts from
awesome.
Atlanta right here, and but this insane death metal show is about to start up here upstairs in heaven. We got Taproot downstairs and in hell, and that's and who else is on tour with you right now?
Right now we have Catharsist, they're a really cool young band, and A Liar's Eyes, another really cool young band. So.
Awesome.
Very fun.
Very cool. That's what it's all about. Well, I definitely appreciate you doing this podcast with me again. We'll pull up part two in a few weeks.
Absolutely.
And thanks for tuning in. This is the Rock Mob Podcast. I'm Ryan Bennett, your host. And again, Mike DeWolf.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Rock and roll.